UFO Radio. Today we're speaking again with one of our favorite guests, Dr. Clifford Alford. He has neuropathic and shamanic services in Oregon, New Mexico. You can find his site at www.nassinc.org, and that's NASSINC.org. Hi, Clifford. How are you doing today?
Just fine. And yourself?
Oh, good. I'm really good. Thank you. We decided what we'd like to do is put a show together because there's been so many people in our Ancient Mysteries group and in our chat rooms talking about the Earth changes going on right now and the polar shifts, as well as the proton belt. So for the listeners, what I did is I've been contacting Clifford here with questions, and we decided what we'd do is just put together a show so that we could answer some of these questions directly. As you all know, I'm no professional on this, but Clifford is. So anyhow, with no further ado, let's hear from Clifford on what his theories are as far as the Earth changes go, the polar shifts, and the proton belt, what we should be expecting.
Well, personally, we began noticing that there was something going on about 5 years ago. There was a lady named Marie Gilchrist in Sparrowhawk Village just out of Tahlequah, Oklahoma, who donated some land to us to build a medicine wheel on. And there's another medicine wheel pretty close by that had been built also. The one we were building was for to bring healing and justice to the earth, and this other one had been built as a means of communication, and so we were building the two fairly close together. And the one that had been built before had been built by some people who were real good at it, and we knew that things were correct there. But as we were checking things out to set up with the other one, we had several different compasses of different types and stuff to make sure we would get everything just right on. And we noticed that what was considered to be north by all of these different compasses didn't really quite line up with this other one. And so there were some people who live in Sparrowhawk Village, a lady named Nikki Van Thiel, and Beverly Van Thiel, then we went over to their house because even though we hadn't seen them in a while, it was we had noticed many times that there was a little problem with the sun when we were eating in their home in the evening. It'd be coming right through this window, just blinding you in the dining room. And so I asked Beverly, you know, have you seen any kind of a change in the sun? And she said, yeah, you know, we were just talking about that the other day. It used to come in through this window over here on this wall, and now it comes in through the patio door over here on this other wall. And in our measuring of things, and what we found at that point is there had been a 14-degree shift.
And that's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. And it obviously had happened fairly quickly because the two different medicine wheels were built about 3 years apart. So, you know, it was an interesting little situation for us. And we started checking with other people around, and they were noticing the same thing. For instance, that the sun would be further south than it used to be and things of that nature. So as we checked with other people in other parts of the world, yeah, they were getting the same thing. Well, about that time, one of my apprentices came in with an interesting little report about how she had been talking with some people who worked with U.S. Geological Survey. And having a friend who worked for USGS, then I was interested in her information and started talking to them. And my friend's name is Earl. I won't tell you his last name because he got in trouble for this before and wouldn't want to get in trouble for it again.
Okay.
And basically at the time, USGS on their website was putting out some information about things that were going on in the world that was in their realm of interest. Well, Earl is a mine specialist. Basically, he goes down in mines and he checks stuff out and sees how, you know, what their stability is and all that sort of thing. But they had him go with a bunch of folks from the U.S. Meteorological Society and NOAA and different organizations of this nature down to Antarctica. And what they'd been seeing was a change in the polar ice caps in a very interesting way. For instance, the polar ice cap when the Nautilus submarine was launched back in the 60s, the first nuclear submarine, the first thing the USS Nautilus did was go under the ice cap and measure to see how thick it was, and on the average it was around 6.5 feet thick. Well, now the polar ice caps are around 3 feet thick.
Wow.
Yeah, they're melting a lot, and that's the reason the polar bears and the seals up there and stuff are dying out. It's too warm for them. Well, the interesting thing then to figure out was that since the oceans weren't rising at that point, where was the water going? And in looking at things, they found that Ross Bay, if you look at a map of South America, Ross Bay is just a little bit off the tip of Argentina and a little to the left. And it's always been pretty much locked in with ice. But now they've been having quite a buildup there to where there are some things that are going in that are concerning them. Some of the scientists who are stationed in Antarctica on a regular basis were noticing that right along the coast it was raining in the summer. We're not talking snow or ice, okay? We're talking rain in Antarctica.
Hmm.
You know? And what they attributed this to was the release of industrial gases and toxins into the atmosphere that are pooling over both the North and South Pole. Over the North Pole, the effect has been the melting of the ice there, but Antarctica, you know, is actually a continent, and it's larger by far than the polar ice cap. So the ice and stuff all around the edges and stuff then is getting a little bit of a different treatment. Well, they began to realize they had a problem with Ross Bay because that's where most of the ice is building up. And so they sent this team of scientists down to study everything, and they wanted to see if it was possible to stop this warming trend there and the rain that was going on and kind of get things back to normal, you know, or what they had to do, you know, if there was anything they could do. Well, when Earl got there, he and his assistant took boring machine, a tunneling machine that was actually built by the Russians, and went down into the ice in over Ross Bay. And the thing is, it's 1,500 feet tall, this ice sticking up out of the ocean. It's 1,500 feet tall.
Uh-huh.
That's a lot of ice. Well, when they got in there, they found out that there was actually a bubble under the ice, you know, actually coming up out of the water a little bit. And it's a very large bubble, you know, it's not like some little bubble we might blow in the bathtub or something. The problem, too, is that where it's raining is it's right along the back edge of that bubble.
Uh-huh.
And Earl said that he and his assistant got out of there just as fast as they could because what they saw just scared the daylights out of them.
How so?
And since they were stuck there for a while, then all these little scientists ran around and did all the usual things you do on Antarctica if you're a scientist and get to go there, like actually go to the South Pole and all this sort of stuff, because they're not going to get to do it again. And the reason they were doing this and saying that when they came back, and then it was shut down from the USGS website in a hurry because of the fear it generated, is that where it's raining, the ice shelf in Ross Bay is going to break. And at the time, it was a little bit larger than the size of the states of Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Missouri, kind of like all put together. And it's been growing continuously since then. And the thing is, it's going to break. There's not a hope in the world of avoiding it. And when it does, we're going to have a problem. The kind of give you a little edge into the problem, the piece of ice broke off of the Ross Ice Shelf last year that was about the size of the state of Pennsylvania. And it raised the level of the oceans by about an inch and a half And they said that by the time it gets through melting, it will have raised the level of the oceans by about 3 inches. Well, when this piece that's as large as all these states plus several more by now, considering its rate of growth, they say that when it breaks, that it will cause a tidal wave 1,500 feet tall that will scour the edges of the continents. It will initially raise the level of the water in the oceans by 125 feet. For example, most of Florida and Texas underwater, most of the South will be gone. The East Coast, the West Coast, like you don't need to worry about California falling in the ocean, it's going to be the ocean.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the islands and stuff will just be gone, period.
Well, there's a lot of the salt out there that's under seawater anyhow, or seawater level.
Yeah, and a lot of, you know, my little sister was living in a little place just north of Los Angeles, and I think it was called Ventura or something like that. She was managing an apartment complex there, and they were actually having chunks of condominiums falling off in the ocean and stuff as the water levels were coming up. She's since then moved to Minnesota. Well, the thing with this big chunk of ice is it's going to take about 25 years for it to melt, is what they figure. And as it goes up into, it's further up into the Pacific Ocean. And when that melting takes place, then it's going to raise the level of the oceans to around 300 feet. The level of the oceans and the water all over the world is going to go way up. Some of these people who've predicted such things as, pole shifts that cause different, cataclysmic reproportionings of the world, like cutting the United States into four pieces and all this stuff,
mm-hmm.
are going to be pretty correct in that. And so if you're living below 325 feet, say, of, if you're living 325 feet or less above sea level, then it might be a good idea to move.
Mm-hmm.
The scientists that were a part of this, they came back and said this is absolutely going to happen. There is nothing that we can do to prevent it.
And this was on this was reported on the site, and then the U.S.
It was reported on the U.S. Geological Survey site.
Mm-hmm.
It was there for several weeks, and then all of a sudden it was off. Nobody would talk about it. And I called Earl, and I said, okay, I want to ask you some questions about this. And he said, I'm not allowed to comment on it.
Oh, really?
And I said, okay, let's try it this way. How about you answer the things that you can, and the things that you can't answer them because it gets you in trouble, just say no comment. I said, I can do that.
Okay, good.
And so we had this conversation to the point that the information that I just relayed to you is true, because every time I would say, is this true, he would say, no comment.
Okay.
So, that's the thing. And then they actually monitored the call, and he got in trouble for it. So.
They've actually tapped his phones?
Yeah.
To make sure that he doesn't get the
phone of every scientist that was part of it.
Wow.
So, they're worried about people having some kind of panic and leaving areas destitute and all this sort of stuff. And, so fine, let them leave those areas destitute. People have the ability to move and want to. I mean, get on with it, because it's coming. What we see from this is, and other things that are going on around the world, there are all kinds of pressures building. For instance, Mammoth Lake not too long ago, a few years ago, got to the point that they were almost boiling. There were gases coming up out of it. All the animals in the area headed east.
Now, where's Mammoth Lake?
It's in California.
Okay.
And so there were, all these different things going on then, and we were getting reports on that. Now the Shoshone have been monitoring what's going on up in Yellowstone. And if you consider that virtually half of every dollar that the federal government is able to take in right now goes to Bush's war of imperialism, then the last thing they want to do is shut down their biggest resort area for the national parks, which is Yellowstone. And so they're not being real honest about that, but the Shoshone, who basically is their country, you know, they go in and monitor the stuff. And they're getting reports that the level of the lake, which is, you know, I think the lowest part's around 300 feet, has risen up about 100 feet. It's there's a magma core in there that's around 200 degrees hotter than anything they've ever been able to measure before. And the fish all over the lake are dying. You know, up there in the waters and stuff. And so...
I've been trying to get information on what's been going on in Yellowstone, and there's just nothing out there, really.
No, and you're not going to get it because they don't want to scare people off by saying you shouldn't come and do your vacation here, even though this volcano is about to pop and blow your butt away.
And you think it's real close?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. And there are other people, friends of mine who are into this sort of thing, have been out around you know, Mount McKinley and Mount Shasta and all that stuff. And there's a scientist who was doing a lot of work around the Hawaiian Islands, who's developed a way of measuring what's going on in a volcano as to whether it's ready to explode or not. And he had gotten his thing set to the point that he can predict when it's going to happen. And so he went to Mount Shasta, set up his equipment, turned it on, shut it off, and left.
Really?
Because, you know, it's full, it's ready, it can go at any time.
Really? Mount Shasta?
Mount Shasta, yeah.
Now, we haven't heard anything out here about Mount Shasta going.
Yeah, so, you know, this stuff's been, we've been kind of getting reports on this for the past several years, and it's building up, and it's obvious that we're about to have a problem. Now, what's the interesting thing with the pole shift and all of this is that, well, a real good way to visualize it would be to get a piece of paper and draw you a circle, you know, taking up most of the page, and call that the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you consider that the Earth's crust is anywhere from 5 miles thick, which is up at a point up in Colorado, to 40 miles thick all over the world, then you just kind of draw you another circle around it. At least most of that first circle, you know, in the center, you know, most of it free from the lines. You know what I'm saying?
It's free from what?
Yeah, you know, it's like you've got one circle way out on the edge of the page, and then another circle really pretty close to it. So you've got two large circles on the page, one
right, inside
the other. And so all that area in there is full of molten material. It's liquid. And the Earth's crust is simply floating on that liquid. Now, when the Ross Ice Shelf breaks and starts to float out into the Pacific, any weight that is on that on the Earth's surface then is going to be pulling things one way or another on as far as the magma in the center of the Earth. So as it goes out and further north in the Pacific, then you can expect that it's going to either do it very slowly or possibly get to a point where quickly then things are going to shift. You know, they don't know which it's going to do. It's going to do one or the other. And what they're expecting is, and the scientists that is that when it gets out there and there's this shift, then basically things that are, say, on the east coast of the United States are going to go further north, and things that are on the west coast are going to go further south and do it rapidly. If it goes real fast, then they expect it's going to generate winds that will be in excess of 200 miles an hour for 2 to 3 weeks.
Wow.
There's not going to be a whole lot standing when it's over with.
Now, is this the purpose of the underground tunnel systems that the government's been making?
Well, they've been doing a lot of stuff. Like, for instance, they actually went into, I think it's, well, portion of Ute Mountain, the Southern Ute Reservation up in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
They actually started tunneling in Ute Mountain about the same time as all this was going on. And they said that they were going to dispose nuclear waste in there and all this sort of stuff. And they run out the Utes, you know, from what I understand, whenever they try to go in to see what's going on. So nobody knows what they're really building this thing for. Up in the Detroit area, although I don't know what good it'll do them because Detroit's so low to sea level,
mm-hmm.
is that they have massive tunnels up there that they've been building since World War II. You know, they've got, they basically have a small city of federal employees who work under Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got stuff like that all over the place already, and they're building more. It would make sense that if you're a person in power and you want to take care of you and your family, that you're going to set up something to do it, especially when you know the facts.
Yeah. Well, you know, it would be nice to let us in on it, too, so that we can make some sort of preparations for something like this, don't
well,
you think?
Well, it would be nice, but you have to remember the definition of politics.
Mm-hmm.
Poly is Latin for many. Tix is Anglo-Saxon for blood-sucking vermin.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. But now, they're trying to blame this on global warming, right?
Yeah.
And we know through the Russians have been doing a lot of work, especially I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong, Dr. Dmitriev, Dmitriev. And he's been working on, he says that all the planets are going through some sort of a change. He even gives examples like the Martian atmosphere is getting sizably thicker than it was before. The Earth's moon is growing an atmosphere also. The moon is growing an atmosphere that's made up of a compound that's referred to as yttrium.
Yeah.
And then he says that the magnetic fields and brightness of the planets are changing. They're experiencing sizable changes in their overall brightness. Venus, for example, is showing us marked increases in overall brightness. Jupiter has gotten to have such a high energetic charge that there is actually a visible tube of ionizing radiation that's formed between its moon. And you can see the luminous energy tubes in photographs that's been taken more recently. It says that Jupiter's magnetic field has more than doubled. Uranus's magnetic field is changing. Neptune's magnetic field is increasing. There again, the planets are becoming brighter. Their magnetic field strength is getting higher. The atmospheric qualities are changing. It says overall volcanic activity has increased 500% since 1975 here on Earth.
And it's going to do more so, yeah.
So, I mean, we're not talking about just what's happening here on Earth.
Oh, no.
This is happening. I mean, this is all over.
Yeah, but this is throughout our solar system. And, you know, the Venus, have you ever heard it referred to as the morning star?
Yeah.
Well, whenever we're doing a vision quest, then, you know, there's the person who's out on the location where they're actually questing at. And then there's someone who is holding their energy. And in the Asagai, what we do is when the light of the dawn gets to the point, it used to be, it would get to the point where it would make us not see the morning star anymore, then we'd sing the sunrise greeting song and get on with the rest of the day. When the last few times that we've been out on vision quests, that I've personally been helping someone with it about the past year or so, about 2 years now, is that the light of the dawn gets up to Venus and keeps on going, and you can still see Venus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you know, things are definitely getting brighter. And if you, I don't know what the weather's like up there where you're at, but down here in the desert, our nights are generally just extremely clear.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, you know, the planets, you can see them so much clearer now, even to the point that a lot of them that you would have used a microscope or a good strong pair of binoculars to to look at before, you can see them pretty clearly without any aid at all.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's correct. Now, one of the things that's going with that is that the Russians were the first ones who were able to measure, the distance between the Earth and the Sun, and get it down, to a real good sharp point. You know, NASA tried to claim it and all this sort of stuff, but the truth is, our people stole the information from the Russians.
Yeah.
And they determined that that distance from the Earth to the Sun was one helios. And the interesting thing that folks like Demetrius and others came up with just a few years ago was that normally in their measurements of things, the leading edge of the solar system was at, it was 10 helios from the Sun.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden it jumped right about the time of the harmonic convergence, another alignment of planets, it jumped to 110 helios.
Really?
So people were talking about things seem faster, time seems to be going quicker, there's all sorts of energy changes going on since then. Well, that's why. And it's continuing. I don't know what it's at now, but you can bet it's increasing, especially with the harmonic concordance that took place on the 8th of November.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
I came across a website last night in my studying, and this guy is out. I have it on my burlingtonnews.net/today, where you can just click on it and give your remarks. But he said that he has noticed, like you had said, that time is changing. Like sometimes people are experiencing different phenomena, such as repeats, repetition of the same event, or missing time, or things seem to appear from the past.
Yeah.
You know, like things are. You know, I don't know how to explain it. Maybe you can do a better job than I can. But he says that he can actually see, or, that he has actually, that's what he's studying now, and is asking people to, if they've experienced something like this, to click onto his website and fill out this form, because he's trying to collect data on it.
Yeah, there have been people who have also experiencing things like they're going someplace, and they get there a whole lot faster than they should have.
Yeah.
Things of that nature. Like if you're going east, it seems like you get places faster than if you're going west.
Yeah. It's hard to understand that, for us.
Yeah.
Of how this can possibly, unless, you look at it as the ancients did, that our life, our reality is an illusion, and the illusion is breaking down.
We tell people all the time in their training in the medicine society that this world is an illusion. Time is an illusion. It's a physical construct for humans. Nobody else in creation needs it.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist for them. There's no time or distance in the spirit realm.
Now, this takes me to something that I found interesting was that our ages, the dark age to the gold, or let's start with the golden age of Lemuria. And then something very similar to what is happening now happened then. And that was in a golden age, and then we went into the dark ages. And this dark age is like is some sort of an illusion, and it's an age of negativity. And an age of darkness, and now we're going through this photon belt with all this high amount of radiation. Where, and when we get through it, I forget how long it takes, but when we finally get, I think that we started going through it in the year 2000. But when we finally get through, it's like a pendulum, and when we finally get through it, we'll be in another golden age, and that age will be a mirror. Image of this age, but without the negativity. It's not an age of darkness, it's an age of light.
That's a feeling that a lot of people have been getting, and a lot of the elders have been coming up with. But we've also been having some other interesting things happen to where, well, it's kind of like that crop circle picture that you showed
me. Yeah.
Basically what I got in talking to the spirits about it is that it is, you know, it's a mirror on either end, and it's basically, it represents, both ends represent the same energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that what comes into the middle, what comes into our existence, is up to us. And but the point is that we're only going to have two choices. Now, there's a pretty funny little movie out called The Rundown that has The Rock starring in it. And my daughter got it, and we watched it the other night. It was pretty funny, but he was talking about, well, you've got option A, or you've got option B, and there's no option C. Well, this is what we have. We have option A, which is another golden age of enlightenment right now, or option B, which is moving into a time that's going to make the dark ages of Europe look downright tame.
Really?
Yeah. And we're going to know which one we've chosen, humanity as a whole. We're going to know which one we've chosen by the end of next year.
You know, this is why I have so much respect for you, is I was on your website and I was reading, and I added it to that website that we have on Burlington News. And that is your outlook of how the Native Americans and the Caucasians and all of us have to come together and share information now for the healing of Earth. And if we don't become one in our way of thinking, in our way of taking care of Earth, that we just won't survive.
Yeah. That's been kind of a battle we've had in Native America for about the past 40, 50 years, is when people started to teach outside the tribes to other people. Then when the American Indian Movement started up, they were attacking, I should say we at that point, were attacking anybody who would teach outside of the Native tradition to other people. And finally there was, you know, some people like Bad Bear and Sun Bear and others who were doing this, Wallace Black Elk, you know, they were Brooke Medicine Eagle, you know, they were all teaching these other people, and they started the Rainbow Movement.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing that they had to say to us was like, you know, we're supposed to be the Earth Keepers. There are more of them than there are of us, so if we don't teach them, we're all going to die.
Yeah.
And, you know, when the Earth dies, the rest of us are gone too. I mean, there are a lot of people who get this notion that, well, we can just leave and go to another planet. Well, not exactly.
Yeah.
You know, this is our mother.
Yeah.
And we can take care of her, and if we do so, then she can take care of us, or otherwise we're gone.
I mean, why leave for another planet?
Exactly.
I mean, what beauty we have here, right here on Earth.
Yeah, well, take a little clue when the probe was sent to Venus. And they were real interested in all of these gases and stuff that they saw there. And as this probe was parachuted into the atmosphere of Venus as it was going through, it started getting down a ways, and they could see what appeared to be structures that used to be maybe buildings and things of that nature. And
in Venus?
Yeah, in Venus.
Really?
Yeah, and it was on the news. I mean, it's bound to be possible to find it if someone hasn't edited things since then, I don't know. Because it was only on the news one time, and we were watching, my wife and I were watching this news broadcast, and they were talking about what they saw, because as the camera finally got down far enough, it melted. It was eaten up by the acids in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And so this one reporter asked, well, what does this all mean? And they said, and the scientists who were up there in front were kind of milling around and stuff. And one of them said, well, we should let Dr. So-and-so answer that. And this guy comes walking up who looks like, you know, the nerd from hell. I mean, he's got this old suit on, you know, funny bow tie and all this sort of stuff, and looks just as dorky as he can be. But when he starts talking, everybody in the place got quiet. because what he said is best that we can figure is that there was a civilization there like ours, because the gases in the air that ate the probe were industrial toxic waste.
Really?
We have. And he said, it may be just conjecture, but it's entirely possible that to have the kind of toxic waste that they did is that they were at our level and maybe a little beyond, and it's entirely possible that they put their best and brightest minds, in other words, the same people who would then perpetuate the same lifestyle they had then, you know, their best children, their best scientists, and all this stuff, and sent them to another world, and we are doing it again right
mm-hmm.
here.
Yeah.
And that was the end of it. And, you know, I think it was Heather that was commenting afterwards, as well, that was kind of strange, you know, and just kind of went on to another story.
If any of you listeners out there happen to have that tape, would you please send it to Burlington News, and then we'll also make a copy available for anyone else that wants to watch it, and we'll also send a copy to Dr. Alford here.
I would be tickled, please.
Pardon?
I would be tickled pink.
Oh, you betcha. We really need that. That's a very important piece of information that we need, because there's so many people that are trying to deny the existence of a civilization that was ever from Venus. And we know through our Lemurian research that there is a possibility that there was a civilization from Venus that landed here on Earth, right?
Well, actually, if you can get Mark Pinkham on your show.
Oh, I had Mark Pink. Mark was just on our show last week.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes, yes. As a matter of fact, we talked a little bit. Yes, we, as a matter of fact, talked a little bit about you. You'll have to listen to the show. Wonderful person. I'm going to meet with him in Sedona in July.
I'm looking forward to meeting him personally one of these days myself.
Oh, wonderful person, yeah. But go on about Mark. Please.
Well, the thing is that in his book, The Return of the Serpents of Wisdom, it talks about the Kumaras, the androgynous beings that came to this world and taught the ancient society in Mu, and basically, now it's about 104,005 years ago, basically, when the medicine society that became the Siddha was founded. And they were the ones that taught them.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was really fun to see in his book that he talked about that. I mean, this is a legend, if you will, that's been handed down from our history's word of mouth for thousands of years. And nobody wrote it down, and he did it.
Yeah. This man, I just, you know, from listening to all the experiences that he's had and all the teachers, because he's a fairly young man. And it's hard to fathom that he's accomplished so much in his lifetime. The wisdom that man has is just unbelievable.
I would guess that he has done that because he's accomplished so much in so many other lifetimes.
Yeah.
And short of a miracle, I mean, just from, this is conjecture on my part, but if things hold together long enough that one of these days Jorge Delgado decides to step down from leading the Siddha, I wouldn't be surprised if Mark Amory Pinkham is the next head of the Siddha worldwide.
He talked on the show about he wanted to study with these Buddhists, I believe it was, in India, some initiates there, adepts. Anyhow, he managed to get to Africa. All right, by boat, I imagine. But from Africa, he was so determined to get there. From Africa, he actually walked to India. Hitched rides from various people until he got there. Now that's determination.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I'm just amazed by that man. You know. You said they figure that peace would break in approximately 25 years, or no longer than 25. Could it be any time, or do they figure it probably...
They don't know when it's going to break. I said it would melt over a period of 25 years.
Oh, so it could break anytime.
I don't know when it's going to happen. They said it could happen, you know, in the next 10 seconds, and it could happen, you know, 100 years from now.
And that's why they wanted to get off there as quickly as possible.
They know that it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. They can't figure that out.
You know, it almost makes me think of a rubber band, and you're stretching it. And how long can it maintain the pressure before it finally gives?
Yeah, and you know, we have all sorts of interesting things happen in the world all the time that indicate that it's that way. For instance, when they were dropping their bunker buster bombs in Iraq,
you
know, when they first began the invasion of those people, then on this side of the world, like in Florida, there were something like 11 tornadoes just popped up spontaneously overnight. In other places in the world, we can see where there's some war going on, and something happens on the other side of the world. It's, you know, you got all that liquid in there. And so, you know, we talked about the drum being the heartbeat of Mother Earth. Well, Mother Earth is a drum. And if you beat on one side, there's a concussive effect on the other side.
Well, it goes back to the chaos theory, right? If a butterfly flaps its wings on one side of the earth, there could be a hurricane on the other. Now this is something that has happened before, and there has been people that have survived, right?
Yeah. Well, if you want to have
I want to say this for, you know, for the listeners, because I don't want to set listeners into panic on this. I think that one of the things we need to do is let people realize that they can survive and what they should be doing now to prepare themselves for something.
Yeah, there are bunches of people who survived. And if you just go back to the last flood, for an example, there was, you know, Noah and his crew supposedly talked about in the Jewish Bible.
Yeah.
Well, if you go back before that, well, not before that, but from that, but see, there are, you know, there's a tradition of people who hollowed out logs and, you know, kind of rafted all these logs together and got inside the logs and floated around from Europe over to what's now, you know, the extreme northern parts of this country. The Hopi talked about how 10,000 people went into, you know, down into a cave and then up into this hollow mountain and were in there until they could come out again. You know, that's 10,000 people in one place survived.
Yeah.
You know, so there's nothing that says that even though this is going to happen, that you can't survive it. I mean, a little preparation is a good thing. If you're in a low coastal area and there's just no way you can move, well, get you a nice self-inflating raft or something. Keep it in your garage. If you need it, blow it up and go for a ride.
Uh-huh.
You know, there are all kinds of things that people can do to prepare for these things. You can put food back. You can have, you know, clean water on hand. If there are caves and stuff in the area that you know about, well, you can go and hope that you're the only one that's doing it there, but maybe cache some stuff there. You know, there's all sorts of stuff. You can learn about survival. I mean, there's so much food on this earth that it's not even funny. And most of it's better than you get in the grocery store.
Yeah.
Another thing also that you can do from both an exoteric and esoteric standpoint is learn things that will help you know when things are going to happen and how to predict it and how to work with it. And probably the best way to do that I've found so far is an organization I told you about before, you know, Esoteric Theological Seminary.
Mm-hmm.
If you go on their website, which is www.northernway.org, and go into their mystery school section, they have an outfit, and they're called the Eternal Order of the Magi. And they teach the same stuff that the Magi of Persia and Egypt and all these other places used to share. And they do it over the Internet. You know, and you can learn the kind of things that they knew and did and still do, really, you know, and do it yourself and be able to understand all of these natural laws that govern all this stuff. And even though people say that, you know, spiritual law and natural law are not the same thing, they really are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, nothing functions outside of natural law. So if people learn this type of thing and then get on with doing it and making it a serious part of their life, then they're going to have forewarning as to when things are coming and what they need to do. It doesn't matter where they are.
Mm-hmm.
They'll know what they need to do.
And so, okay, so we're looking at Mount Shasta possibly erupting any time. We're looking at Yellowstone possibly erupting at any time.
Yeah.
We're looking at the Antarctica, that breaking at any point of time, the ice caps there. And what else? What about up in Washington?
Mount McKinley.
Yeah.
So.
Is that, how is that doing up there, do you know?
Well, you know, it's kind of in the same situation as Shasta. You know, they know it's going to happen, they just don't know when. You can go up to places like, I believe it's called Cockerville, up in, it's about a four-hour drive out of Fairbanks on the coast of Alaska. And it's warmer there, all through the winter than it is in other places because they're surrounded on three sides by volcanoes. They don't have smoke rolling out of them and all this sort of stuff, but they're not so silly as to say that these are inactive.
Mm-hmm.
You come down here to southern New Mexico, Las Cruces in Oregon, you know, where I live, is surrounded by volcanic peaks.
Mm-hmm.
And these people say, oh, they're dormant, they're dead, you don't have to worry about it. No, they're not.
Yeah.
And yes, you do.
we have a home up in the White Mountains, up in Sholo, Arizona. And the teacher one time told my son, I mean, you know, there's volcanoes